You're listening to BBC History Magazine's weekly podcast. I'm Dave Musgrove, the editor of the magazine, and this is the first of our August 2011 editions. BBC History Magazine is on sale in all good newsagents and on subscription. Visit historyextra.com for more information, or follow us at twitter.com/historyextra or facebook.com/BBC History Magazine. Coming up, we have...
There's a lot more to be said about Mary. She's certainly more than the kind of caricatured Catholic tyrant.
That was Anna Whitelock there, talking about Queen Mary I.
One of the problems that the English and the Welsh have in the 13th century is they're culturally very different.
That's Mark Morris on Edward I's invasion of Wales.
It's one of the finest castles in the world, and I love it because it's had permanent military presence there from the Iron Age to the Cold War.
That was Dan Snow on Dover Castle. So, our first interview is with Dr. Anna Whitelock of Royal Holloway, University of London. She is our guide in the fourth of our series on the Tudor monarchs, and she'll be talking about the life and times of Queen Mary I. If you're new to the podcast, listen back to our last three episodes and you can hear other historians discussing the reigns of Mary's predecessors. Queen Mary, who ruled from 1553 to 1558, has come down to us now with a moniker, Bloody Mary. But as Anna Whitelock is about to explain, she has been undergoing something of a reassessment of late.
Obviously, there's a lot to talk about with Mary, even though she had quite a short reign.
That's never normally said. That's a kind of new, that's a revisionist idea that there's a lot to say about her.
We'll get on to that, I think. But the first thing I want to ask you is, what would you say are the key moments in Mary's reign?
Well, as I would say, first of all, her accession. The manner of her accession, which of course was a victory of the localities against the centre, which again, you know, wasn't then seen again until the Civil War. So it was a rising of the localities which defeated central government. But of course, it was also the accession of it became the accession of England's first crowned queen. So it was groundbreaking in terms of its significance. So I think her accession, for all kinds of reasons, which we'll probably come on to, is key.
Okay.
Secondly, I would say the Act for Regal Power, which is the short title for a very, very long title, Act. But this sounds very dry and dusty and boring, but actually this Act, which was passed in April 1554, basically meant that in law, females had all the power of male monarchs. So the one of the sort of parts of the title is that female monarchs would rule as fully and absolutely as their male predecessors. Because up until that point, statute law referred only to male monarchs. And so some of Mary's kind of supporters were saying you could actually rule above the law when you become queen, because actually no, you know, female monarchs aren't even mentioned by law, so you don't even have to keep to the law. And Mary decided that no, she wants to rule according to the law, but she's going to confirm the act which says that she has all the power of a king. So this is, you know, this is kind of degendering, if you like, gender neutralising the monarchy. So massive significance. Marriage to Philip, another key moment. Obviously, the Anglo-Spanish alliance. It's been one of the things that she's then been subsequently criticised for, of course. But I think we can also see that it was quite politically pragmatic, that we shouldn't see it as an inevitable failure. And I think perhaps that the fact that Elizabeth was able to prevaricate over marriage was perhaps partly due to the fact that Mary's marriage had proved so unpopular, and so that kind of gave Elizabeth a bit of room for manoeuvre over the question. But also, of course, Mary had negotiated that very delicate balance of being a ruling queen, but expected to be a subservient wife. And so that whole question was addressed in Mary's reign. And then I think sort of her Guildhall speech, which was a speech in the midst of rebellion, a rebellion, Wyatt's rebellion, against the Spanish marriage. And this was, in a way, this happened in January, February 1554. And this was really a moment where she articulated queenship. We really see this articulated for the first time. And she rides out to the Guildhall and she makes this speech, which in many ways has the same kind of rhetorical flourishes as Elizabeth's Tilbury speech, which of course is so famous. And she basically says, you know, as a mother doth love the child, I love you, pluck up your heart, you know, we will defeat these rebels. And in a way, she kind of articulates queenship and she puts it in feminine terms, which is quite bold. You know, she's actually saying, you know, understand me and see me as a woman and see that as, you know, a strength. You know, I'm trying to, I'm making a virtue of my femininity. So it's quite a bold statement. But yes, it sort of articulates queenship. And the rebels were defeated and the marriage treaty was passed in Parliament. So that's, you know, that was an important point. Phantom pregnancies. You know, it's part of the popular narrative of Mary's reign. She had these phantom pregnancies, June 1555. She thought she was pregnant. And here I think we see the vulnerability of the Queen and we see the importance, I think, of the body of the Queen and how monarchs' bodies had been important up until this point. But of course, when you have a woman, it's a whole level of significance and vulnerability, you know, the sort of the vulnerability to sexual slander and rumours that we sort of see under Elizabeth later, but the whole question of fertility, whether you can produce an heir or not. And of course, here is Mary thinking that she's pregnant, letters are drawn up in advance, ready to announce the fact that she has an heir. And even, you know, word gets out that she's in fact given birth and then bells are rung and then they have to decide, they say, oh no, actually it hasn't happened. And this becomes a farce really. And it really starts to undermine Mary's credibility. And it's sort of, you know, having made these great strides to overcome her gender, it really emphasises the kind of frail body of a queen. And I think thereafter, in a way, it becomes increasingly a sense of the reign as being sort of barren, which of course is what historians have traditionally sort of bought into this idea of this sterile, barren reign with a barren queen. So I think that's important. Of course, the burnings, another important thing, and the loss of Calais, you know, yep. England's last territory in France. Philip persuades Mary to join his war against France. Calais is lost. And, you know, people say, you know, this is the final nail in the coffin of Mary's reputation. And of course, she dies soon afterwards. So it's sort of Calais and the burnings that are really held against Mary, I think.
Okay, loads of points to pick up on there. Firstly, the accession question. How much was she wanted to be queen after the death of Edward?
Well, of course, I mean, the death of Edward, Edward wanted to prevent a Catholic accession. He wanted to protect the Protestant settlement, the Protestant church that he had established. Him and Mary had had quite, not violent, but a very emotional spats during his reign. Edward sort of saying, you know, fall into line, you will not observe Catholicism, and Mary saying, absolutely, I will. On his deathbed, wrote Mary out of the line of succession, and instead, ultimately, of course, Lady Jane Grey, who people are sort of familiar with, was declared queen.
Can I just stop you? We've only covered five Tudor monarchs here.
Yeah.
And Jane Grey hasn't been included. Is that a blunder on my part?
You're okay. She wasn't a Tudor, and she wasn't crowned a monarch. Okay, so she was declared queen, she was proclaimed queen, but she wasn't crowned. And of course, she wasn't a Tudor. So you're okay. But she did, you know, she was significant in the fact that she was who Edward thought and named would be the heir who would then preserve the Protestant church. Mary, at the time of Edward's death, was basically hanging out in East Anglia with her small household, moving between residences. The Edwardian government, who were then obviously championing Lady Jane Grey, were based in London. They had the armoury, the treasury, munitions, all the instruments of government at their disposal. And of course, the Tower. Mm-hmm. Lady Jane Grey takes possession of the Tower, really important. So Mary's this figure who has no apparent prospect. Even the Emperor Charles V, who has been her great champion all through the years of divorce and the Catherine of Aragon, being pressured by Henry to acknowledge her, the invalidity of her marriage, all of that, Charles V has been crucial. And even he sort of says she hasn't got a chance. What happens? There is, for a few days, a kind of conflicting picture of people declaring loyalty to Lady Jane Grey. But gradually, Mary's support gathers. Initially, it's Mary's household who mobilise those immediately around them. And it's a Catholic household, as you would expect. Mm. So they support, they mobilise their, you know, their men, the commons in East Anglia. And Mary then flees from Hunsdon in Hertfordshire, where she is, to Kenning Hall in Norfolk. And then as her support swells, she moves to Framlingham Castle in Suffolk. And we start to see a story of legitimacy triumphing over religion. And we see that people, although they knew Mary was Catholic, of course, and they knew Lady Jane Grey was Protestant, Mary quite pragmatically played down her Catholicism. And instead, she focused on the fact that she was the legitimate heir of Henry. So ultimately, the reason that this sort of figure that had been written off and was, you know, had no apparent chance, it was legitimacy that ultimately secured her the throne.
What were Mary's main achievements?
The first woman to be crowned Queen of England, I think there's no doubt that that would be the biggest achievement. And I mean, what that means is that she, for the first time, had to negotiate and change and reform or redefine law, as I've mentioned, with the Act for Regal Power, ritual and ceremony. You know, how did you crown a queen? For example, one of the rituals in advance of the coronation would be that Knights of the Bath would be created, you know, an order, a chivalric order, and 15 of them would be created. And part of that ceremony would be that they would plunge naked into the bath and then come out and kiss the monarch's shoulder. Now, immediately you have a situation whereby, how does that happen? And so immediately you have Mary having to deputise and give that position to, or sorry, Mary having to, the Lord Steward deputises for her. And so immediately these kind of changes, of course, you know, the monarch's private apartments, I mean, sort of, well, it's kind of, everybody I think seems to know this now, that, you know, the groom of the stool under Henry, who was in charge of, you know, the royal commode, really, really important position. Well, under Mary, you can't have all these men in the private apartments. So suddenly they're filled with women. How does that work? And so there's all these kind of precedents. The question of marriage Mary faces. All of these things that are faced for the first time. So I think that's the biggest achievement. And also, Mary, by winning the throne as she does, of course, she also preserves the Tudor line of succession. I mean, she made Elizabeth's succession possible. Because, of course, you know, if she hadn't become queen, then it would have diverted the succession down a different route. And the political sort of dimension of Mary's reign, I think, has been massively overlooked. And the Elizabethan spin doctors, if you like, have John Fox, most of all, Book of Martyrs, has done the most amazing job, really, at putting Mary's reign firmly kind of into the dark and Elizabeth into the light. And people almost thinking that Elizabeth was the first crowned queen. And not even sort of seeing Mary as her sort of trailblazer.
Okay. What are the failures that you can see? What went wrong in her reign?
Well, the main failure was kind of two-pronged, I suppose, was the failure to produce an heir and her untimely death. You know, the failure of her body, if you like, to endure the fact that she dies only after 5 years. Now, in a sense, that's a sort of slightly revised view than you might have had, or you might get from other historians, or you would have got from me probably a few years ago. Because, of course, what she's most condemned for is the burnings. Mm. Even that aspect of Mary's reign has recently been reconsidered, most notably by Eamon Duffy.
Yeah.
And in his book, Fires of Faith, he kind of, you know, quite controversially describes the burnings as broadly effective. That actually, first of all, we need to put the burnings in the context of the time. Burning was the established punishment for heresy. Yes, it was undoubtedly severe and intense, a period of persecution, but, you know, it certainly wasn't unprecedented. And that in some sense, you know, it was effective in stamping out that, you know, hard core of Protestants. And Eamon Duffy would argue that by the end of Mary's reign, Catholicism was broadly accepted. So I think the failure for her reign, you know, we shouldn't just think, oh, well, the burnings, that shouldn't have happened, and impose some kind of 21st century attitude about that. I think the failure really was that if she'd lived longer, it would have been a very different situation. And if she'd had an heir, again, very, very different. And of course, you know, the whole of historiography that for so long was dominated by the kind of Protestant versus Catholic interpretations, that would have been very different. And so, yeah, I think length of reign, failure to produce an heir, main failures.
Okay. Do you think you'd be able to summarise your assessment of her legacy for me? Because I suspect that You know, if I'd have asked you this question maybe 10, 20 years ago, the legacy would have been one of unending bleakness, very, you know, she wasn't well received. But now she's being rehabilitated by yourself and by others. What's going on? Why is that? What do we know now that we didn't? And how should we understand her legacy?
Well, yes, I mean, absolutely. I mean, 10 or 15 years ago, you know, we have spectacular, well, Henry VII, founder of the dynasty, Henry VIII, you know, massive in all respects. And then we have this sort of nine-year-old boy and then this weakly woman. And then, of course, the glorious Elizabeth. And so we were, you know, this, it was very much the place you didn't want to be.
Yeah.
Which in a way was why I wanted to do it, because it was kind of, you know, fertile ground for new thought. But yes, I mean, her legacy is what female rule is really, really important. It's placing Elizabeth's reign in a proper context. And I think what started to happen is people have began to see that simply focusing on religion is quite limited a way of understanding Mary's reign. I mean, we've got to put the politics back in, and we've got to understand her as a political figure, not just as a Catholic tyrant. And also, I think, you know, historians are beginning to see continuities in all of the Tudor monarchs' reigns, and actually downplaying things like gender. You know, because in reality, of course, the Tudor monarchy endured in spite of a minority government under Edward, in spite of two female. And it's sort of like, well, you know, actually, many things stayed the same. It remained a personal monarchy where personality was crucial. People who were trusted and favoured by the monarch remained at the heart of politics. And that is a kind of new view, because, of course, it used to be that we should understand politics during the Tudors as all about the council and parliament and, you know, the organs of government. And then increasingly, of course, sort of famously, David Starkey and other people talked about the groom of the stool, the importance of that character under Henry VIII. But then historians are like, well, clearly under a woman, you can't have male trusted intimates, and therefore does everything just go back to being all about organs of government? And of course, no, it just becomes, it's not just exclusively in the Privy Chamber, but Mary would still have trusted individuals, and trust is remains a crucial political currency. And so you start to think, actually, if we take sort of religion and gender or place them in a kind of broader context, actually we can see big issues that are sort of true and across the reign. It's all about royal authority, and all of the monarchs have different challenges about maintaining and exercising and extending royal authority. And so, you know, and those issues are common to all of them. So I suppose Mary is therefore being placed back into that picture, into that landscape. I mean, there's still work to be done on her, but in terms of, I mean, popular perception as much as anything else. But I think, yeah, people are starting to reevaluate all the Tudor monarchs. I mean, the shine's been taken off Elizabeth increasingly too. I mean, maybe it's something about, you know, we all like an underdog, and maybe now we're suddenly seeing Mary was a bit of the kind of underdog in terms of, you know, her prospects of becoming queen, and then in terms of how she's been, you know, she's been dealt a bad hand, perhaps, in terms of how she's been viewed in posterity. And so maybe we want to champion that now.
Dr. Anna Whitelock is lecturer in early modern history at Royal Holloway University of London and director of the MA in Public History course there. She's also author of Mary Tudor, England's First Queen, published by Bloomsbury. We're running this series on the Tudors to time with the August edition of the magazine, A Tudor Special. And we've also produced a special BBC History magazine, Tudors audiobook, where you can hear the full-length interviews that I recorded with all the experts in our Tudor podcast series. Thus, you get half an hour each on Kings Henry VII and VIII, Edward VI, and Queens Mary and Elizabeth. We're charging just £1.99 for this. You can download it via our website, historyextra.com/audiobooks/Tudors, and it's being distributed by audiogo.co.uk. Our next interview is with Mark Morris, who's an expert on both castles and medieval history, so he's a great person to talk to for the next subject, which involves castles and medieval history. We're going to discuss the English King Edward I's invasion of Wales at the end of the 13th century.
So we're talking about the conquest of Wales by Edward I, which you've written about for the magazine in our Where History Happened series. So what we need to do first, I think, is try and set the scene. So could you briefly summarise the situation between England and Wales before Edward came to the throne?
Well, immediately before Edward came to the throne, Edward's father, Henry III, is a good contrast with him, because he's sort of one of England's weak kings. Nice guy, but not a very competent king. Mm. And Henry III's reign is kind of dominated in its middle and later years by baronial unrest, which becomes rebellion, and eventually civil war. So during this time, the ruler of Wales, is able to make hay. You know, it's a good time for the Prince of Wales. England is divided, so Wales can kind of flourish. Now, to say more about Wales, if you go back into the sort of centuries before the 13th century, Wales had always been a very divided country, divided into lots and lots of competing rulers. They called themselves kings, but they were really, it was just a personal designation. They were really sort of, every time you went round another mountain, there was another king.
Mm.
What happens in the 13th century is Wales starts to unify. They start to get over the problem, which they had this ancient custom, which was they divided the inheritance among all the brothers or all the male kinsfolk. So every time you had a king and he died, there would be this carve-up between all the members of the family, even over something like a kingdom. That starts to sort of disappear in the 13th century. That attitude starts to wane, and you get a ruler of Wales in the early 13th century, Llywelyn the Great, and in the mid-13th century, a ruler called Llywelyn ap Gruffydd. And Llywelyn is the first ruler of Wales to style himself Prince of Wales.
Mm.
He's sort of ancestrally Lord of Snowdon, and he owns, or he has inherited, the northwest corner of Wales.
Yeah.
But he, during the reign of Henry III, asserts his dominance over all the other kings and princes of Wales, and is recognised in 1258. He is recognised as Prince of Wales by all the other Welsh rulers. Mm. So Wales is unified.
And was it 1267 that Henry
recognised it? Eventually, when the civil war in England plays itself out, Henry recognises Llywelyn as Prince of Wales, and he is the first English king to recognise a Welshman as Prince of Wales. So this is a kind of a high point in the history of Wales. It's a kind of literally a crowning moment for Llywelyn.
Mm.
But then it all goes wrong.
Okay, so Henry III dies in 1272.
Yeah.
And Edward I comes to the throne. Llywelyn ap Gruffydd is still about,
mm-hmm.
and he's still calling himself Prince of Wales.
Mm.
So how does the dynamic change when Edward comes to the throne then? What's...
Well, it sort of changes in Edward's absence.
Right.
Because and the problem is, if you go back to 1267, that high point, there are a lot of questions left unanswered. And Henry and Edward, as his sort of son and heir, have recognised Llywelyn's gains, territorial gains and title. Mm. But the Marcher Lords, these English barons with whose lands straddle the border between England and Wales, literally a law unto themselves, they're far from happy about the recognition given to Llywelyn, because he's taken a lot of land from them and they want them back. And there are certain territories which are clearly so contentious that they're not even mentioned in that peace treaty, the Treaty of Montgomery of 1267, one of which is the struggle that's going on between Llywelyn and the Earl of Gloucester, Gilbert de Clare.
Mm.
This is a sort of struggle for part of Glamorgan. And that struggle, eventually, Edward goes off on crusade in 1270. And while he's gone, he doesn't come back till 1274. His father dies in his absence. So he's gone for 4 years. And this friction between the Marchers and Llywelyn, particularly at first between Llywelyn and Gilbert de Clare, mounts and mounts and mounts. So Gilbert de Clare is building Caerphilly Castle, which is one of the places I mentioned in the piece.
In South Wales.
And, you know, you can see it's a colossal struggle. Llywelyn attacks it and destroys it. Gilbert rebuilds it. You've literally got this kind of arms race going on in the march, with Llywelyn building castles like Dolvorwyn is one, and English marchers building castles against him. So the march is militarising. So this tension is building up in Edward's absence. So when Edward comes back in 1274, he kind of inherits all these other men's grievances, both Llywelyn's and the marchers. And I think it's to Edward's credit. I think this is something that's it's not exactly a new idea, it's been around for a while, but it's to Edward's credit that he doesn't take sides when he gets back. And as far as we can see, Edward tries to be fairly even-handed in sorting out this dispute. Not least because Llywelyn owes him a ton of money. The Treaty of Montgomery cost about, let's get the figure right, it's 25,000 marks, I think, in the end, which is about 17,000 pounds, which is a huge sum of money. It's equivalent to Edward's, you know, getting on for his annual income from ordinary revenue. So Edward is massively in hock as a result of his crusade. So he wants that money. So all the letters going to his bailiffs on the border and sheriffs are saying, look, let's not upset Llywelyn. You know, let's try and, you know, make sure he's happy and then we get the money. Is the kind of logical inference.
Does Llywelyn have the money?
This is one of the arguments, this is my take on it anyway, is that Llywelyn writes letters saying, we're ready to pay the money just as soon as you sort out the dispute. But Llywelyn clearly doesn't have anything like this sum of money. I mean, one of the first complaints that comes out against him when he after the First Welsh War is how much he's been oppressing his people, trying to screw money out of them. Llywelyn wants the problems in the march solved, and he sort of wants it on his own terms. They end up having an argument about homage, Edward and Llywelyn.
Because Llywelyn owes Edward homage.
Part of the terms of the Treaty of Montgomery, I mean, you might say, if you were sort of coming at this from a sort of Welsh nationalist point of view, why should Llywelyn have bowed down to Edward anyway, you know? Well, the answer is because the Welsh had always done that, you know. Whatever you think of that, the Welsh have been doing that since, you know, the days of King Alfred. And they accepted it. They accepted that was the sort of the natural state of affairs. England, you know, was the dominant power in the British Isles, and they kowtowed to England. They just sort of did it to keep the English off their backs. They didn't sort of really read too much into it. But they'd always done that. And Llywelyn does it very gladly in 1267 because being recognised by England means he is kind of recognised in his position as the dominant power in Wales. So, you know, he's Prince of Wales, and he can turn to the King of England, his overlord, to back that up if other Welsh rulers start to get uppity and try and divide Wales up again. So he's very happy with that state of affairs, but he does pay through the nose for it, as I say, or does agree to mortgage this new principality at a very, very high rate. And the problem for him, I think, by the early 1270s is he can't keep up with the repayments.
Right.
And so then they get into this argument about homage, like, I'll give you the money, you know, once you've sorted out this border dispute. And Edward ends up saying, look, we have no relationship until you bend, you know, kneel down before me and do homage to me. This is the fundamental on which our relationship is based. And Llywelyn starts to try and make that conditional.
Right.
I think there's a personal turning point when Edward goes all the way up to Chester to receive Llywelyn's homage, and Llywelyn doesn't show up. And that really kind of embarrasses Edward, I think. I mean, he writes very angrily to the Pope and saying, we demeaned ourselves to do this, and he didn't show. Yeah. So I think from that point it becomes personal. And then within the next 18 months, there's an inevitable slide to war.
And so the war is personal. Edward is angry.
It becomes personal. But it's, as I say, he's sort of the inheritor of all these other grievances. So yes, I think the 1276-1277 war is really a kind of fairly conventional sort of war of along the lines of, you know, a rebellious vassal won't bow down, and Edward marches in to kind of punish his contumacy. You know, it's not sort of a national struggle, which is what the Second War is about.
Right. So talk us through the First War then. Edward sends in an army from...
Well, leads in. I mean, medieval kings, if they're any good, lead from the front. Edward spends a long time mustering his forces from, you know, the war is declared in November 1276. But the muster isn't due to take place until the following summer. So they have a long time to prepare, and they really kind of muster all the necessary victuals and material in Chester. They also go in mid Wales, and Edward's brother leads a force from the south. So they kind of close in on Wales. Edward leads this very large army into northwest Wales, 16,000 men at one point. Llywelyn is basically sort of surrounded. Edward drives this juggernaut in. They retreat into the mountains of Snowdonia. Now, at this point, see, Llywelyn is probably counting on the fact that he's fought Edward and won in the past. When Edward was heir to the throne, the Lord Edward, he's gone in with Henry III 20 years earlier, and Henry III kind of chases the Welsh back to the River Conwy, looks at the mountains of Snowdonia and says, oh my goodness, it's getting a bit cold. Perhaps we should just leave it at that, you know, push him back into his foxhole, and they just retreat. Whereas when Edward gets to that point, he has this kind of strategic masterstroke of seizing Anglesey, the island off the northwest of Wales, which is lowland, unlike the rest of Gwynedd, which is mountainous. And it's arable land, so that's where all the grain necessary for surviving the winter is going to be for Llywelyn. And Edward sends in about, I think it's 400 or 500 harvesters to seize the Welsh harvest. So it's very much like a siege. He just starves Llywelyn out. And in September 1277, Llywelyn submits.
So that's an end to it then, presumably.
It's the end to a fairly kind of conventional, as I say, conventional war. Although it's done on a sort of grand, impressive scale. Llywelyn submits. He submits to Edward and puts himself entirely at his mercy, at which point Edward is kind of conventionally magnanimous in victory. He first of all charges Llywelyn this huge sum of money for having this very diminished Snowdonia back. But then he waives that when Llywelyn finally swears homage to him. He makes Llywelyn come and do that in Westminster. So it's very symbolic, you know, the Prince of Wales bowing before the King of England in Westminster Great Hall. And so Llywelyn at that point is reduced to what he had been at the start of his career. Although he's called Prince of Wales, it's almost sort of a mockery hanging around his neck because he's just really Lord of Snowdonia now again.
So Edward in 1277 has comprehensively won, and that's the end of the story.
Comprehensively to the extent that he's reduced Llywelyn, put Llywelyn in his place. But he hasn't conquered Wales. He's taken a lot of territory away from Llywelyn. Llywelyn is now very diminished. There's a sort of an interesting question as to whether Edward was aiming for total conquest at that point, which one letter might imply, or whether he was always going to be content to say, well, look, you know, this is going to be a lot of hard work to go into the mountains and chase this guy out. And he's sort of submitted. You know, so it would be kind of an overreaction to kind of, you know, crush him since he's offering to submit. So they just kind of leave it at that.
So why do we have more
fighting?
Why
the second war? Well, the short answer is because the Welsh rebel in 1282. So 5 years later. That takes some explaining. The rebellion, the first thing to say, I suppose, is the rebellion is not started by Llywelyn. It's started by his younger brother, Dafydd. And it's in league with lots of other aggrieved Welsh princes, chieftains, rulers, leaders, call them what you will, lords. It's clearly a well-coordinated national uprising. And the reason behind it is because the English have gone in 1277, taken over large tracts of particularly north and northeast Wales, behaved in a way which has oppressed the Welsh, essentially. If you were being very cynical, you could say, well, this is what they're aiming to do. They're aiming to sort of, you know, provoke them into a fight. I think that's just too cynical. I'm sure the English went in and behaved very badly, as kind of conquerors tend to. One of the problems that the English and the Welsh have in the 13th century is they're culturally very different. They've got very different assumptions about, well, they have different laws. They obviously speak a different language. So, you know, you have English administrators coming to manage these new lands. They can't understand what the natives are saying. It's a traumatic event, the conquest of Wales, as the Norman conquest for the English 2 centuries earlier. You know, the two peoples don't get on. The Welsh sort of complain about English officials. This is a complaint after the event in 1282. They complain about English officials oppressing them, worse than Saracens. They talk about how their laws are being disregarded. So they build up this head of steam, this rhetoric about oppression, which I'm sure to some extent is justified. But I don't think the English went in intending to do that. I think it was just that was the way they thought Wales should be governed.
Right.
You know, the way imperialists do. You know, these people are... the English literally considered the Welsh to be sort of, you know, Untermensch.
Right.
You know, they since the 12th
That's
century...
That's quite strong.
Well, yeah, but they've been writing them up as barbarians. You know, that they had... They were lazy. They didn't, you know, that's why they were so economically backward. They were too lazy to work properly. They just rather stand around, you know, tending sheep than setting themselves to the plough. They were sort of sexually deviant. You know, they married within the prohibited bounds of consanguinity. They had it was very easy to divorce under Welsh law. You know, these are the kind of things being said by the Archbishop of Canterbury. Criticisms levelled at the Welsh in the 13th century.
And do you think English people actually believe that, or were those statements made for political expediency.
No, because they're not being made by politicians. They're being made by sort of monastic chroniclers,
right.
from the sort of 1120s, 1130s onwards. And you know, the one theory is that this, you can see this intensifying in the 12th and into the 13th centuries. I mean, some scholars would disagree, but I certainly see it intensifying. Mm. And so it's a hostile stereotype is created of the Welsh by the English. And of course that affects the way the English as conquerors, when they go in, or you know, the new administrators going into North Wales, to these newly conquered bits of Wales after the First War, treat the Welsh. You know, they're not treating them as equals.
So they rebel. And Edward sends in the armies again.
The Welsh are really cross this time, but Edward is really cross this time. I mean, I think one of the things that you can see that one of the pieces of evidence that suggests it's not a cynical exercise, you know, they weren't sort of just poking the Welsh, prodding them, oppressing them so they could justify a conquest, is that Edward's letters seem truly shocked when he hears about the Welsh rebellion. He's effectively on holiday. He's kind of out in somewhere in the West Country or the Southwest Midlands. He gets news that the Welsh, and it's Easter time as well, it's Holy Week, have risen up and attacked his towns and castles and killed people. And it's been led by Dafydd ap Gruffydd, who was his ally in the First War. He's very cross about Dafydd in particular. Sort of says, you know, we sort of took this man into our trust and, you know, raised him up within the palace. And, he's basically says he's damned, you know, for this. And there's a very, very quick muster then. You know, it's all of a sudden the writs start flying out and Edward is getting men again from all over England, and then also sort of crossbowmen up from Gascony and men from Ireland. It's a sort of all this sort of manpower being poured into Wales. Because, you know, unlike the First War, which is very controlled and it's a very sort of gradual build-up of troops, this is a rebellion. His castles are under attack, so he musters very quickly. He does have the advantage this time, of course, that after the First War, he has cemented his hold on the territories he's taken by building several new castles. Mm. He's built castles like Flint, Rhythlan, and to the south in Aberystwyth. Mm-hmm. So he's sort of surrounded Llywelyn in Snowdonia with castles. On the other hand, it's a more difficult war because it's not just Edward bringing down an unpopular prince in Llywelyn. A lot of the fighting in the First War was done against Llywelyn by the Welsh, by Welsh auxiliaries who surrendered very quickly in the south and ended up joining Edward's army. I think sort of 60-70% of the army in the First War are Welsh against Llywelyn. Whereas this is much more, 1282-3, a war of national resistance against a foreign enemy. So this is much more a national uprising. And so consequently, they're sort of fighting over every castle and every river valley. So they have to kind of go in and kind of take it area by area. So it takes quite a long time to drive into the northwest. Mm. And when they get to winter is approaching in November 1282, the English suffer this big disaster. They're ready to go in for the kill. And we're not sure whose initiative it's taken on, but Edward has built this time a bridge of boats across the Menai Strait from Anglesey to Bangor. And it seems that the local commander just thought, we can go in. They sort of saw an opportunity to get Llywelyn, an assassination attempt, or at least a strategic strike. And it goes terribly wrong. The Welsh kind of see them coming. They descend on the bridge and lots of English knights die by being killed or by drowning trying to get back. So at that point, it becomes, if not before, at that point, it becomes a war of total conquest. The Welsh send Edward a great letter as well, or they send a letter to the Archbishop of Canterbury, but it's clearly intended for Edward, basically saying, we don't recognise you. You know, you're a foreigner, a stranger. Why should the people of Wales bow down before a lord whose laws and tongue and, you know, all these kind of cultural markers, we have nothing to do with you. Yeah. And so it's clearly conceived at that point or expressed as a clash of civilizations, a clash of cultures. And then Llywelyn dies. I mean, Llywelyn realizes he's surrounded, makes this dash for the border to open up a new front, sees an opportunity, but seems to have been lured into a trap and is killed in battle December 1282, mm-hmm. Which is really, although he'd been unpopular at an earlier stage, you know, he is their best chance. You know, if they can't so they can't, once he's gone, they're not going to be able to beat Edward I.
And what about Dafydd?
Dafydd is temporarily takes the title Prince of Wales, but spends the rest of the next, the last 4 months of his life, 3 months of his life, running round, you know, trying to organise resistance, but its resistance is crumbling at that point. The English have crossed the Conwy, they've gone into Snowdonia early in 1283, and this is further than any king of England has gone before, you know, and they're sending in thousands of troops, pushing up from the south, pushing in from the northeast, combing the mountains, looking for Dafydd and Welshmen surrendering in their droves. So this is the Wales in its death throes. Mm. Dafydd is captured on the sort of slopes of Mount Snowdon, taken to Shrewsbury, where he is executed, which is pretty harsh. I mean, the English in since the conquest don't kill noble prisoners. You know, they have a code of chivalry, if you like. So if you look at the history of England between the death of Earl Waltheof in 1076, right down to the early 14th century, no earl is executed. You know, no high-ranking nobleman, and yet here's Edward executing the sort of self-appointed Prince of Wales. Mm-hmm. Now, they could get around that by sort of saying, well, you know, the chivalry doesn't really apply to the Welsh because they're not really playing by the same rule book. But it was clearly seen as a major step. I mean, Edward is quite careful in summoning a parliament to Shrewsbury and making sure it's a kind of a communal decision to execute this man.
Yeah.
But it's a watershed moment.
So the Welsh are defeated, and then Edward further cements his position by building all these astonishing castles.
Yeah, I mean, he's built three castles after the... Well, built three new castles, repaired some old ones after the First War. And then, with Wales conquered, he starts to build more. And the ones that he builds after 1282 are the more famous ones because they are, you know, five times more spectacular. It's almost like, you know, it's, by this point, the English kind of political military machine is up in arms and they are sort of dreaming grandiose dreams. At this point... This is the point where Edward starts to conceive of himself as a conqueror, you know. We sort of imagine these people, I think, originally sort of as small children, kind of playing with their toy castles and such. Oh, when I grow up, I'm going to conquer Wales. But I think it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Once you've conquered a country, there are people coming forward. You know, there are Welshmen submitting. And you know, he knows he's done something which no previous king of England has done, you know. This has been talked about for centuries. But he has now conquered Wales. He's been further than any previous king. So no wonder they start to get big-headed and want to build big, dramatic castles. So he starts building these castles. Conwy, which is a fantastic, compact castle with sort of towers and turrets and flags flying. Harlech, you know, spectacular castle on the west coast. And the grandest one of all is Carnarvon, because unlike all the others, which are, although they are different in many respects, they have certain common features, like they have round towers and whitewashed walls. Carnarvon is not only bigger, but it has polygonal towers and walls which are left bare to reveal stripes of different coloured stone, banded masonry, which, you know, I go with the conventional view here, is a deliberate allusion to the walls of Constantinople. There was a Welsh legend that connected northwest Wales with Constantinople. The Emperor Constantine, well, the Emperor Maximus, who was the father of Constantine, was said to have been born at Carnarvon. So I see it as a deliberate allusion to that imperial past. You know, so Edward is saying, "I'm a new emperor. I'm a new conqueror." There's a reason that castle has eagles on its famous tower, the Eagle Tower. You know, he's building these not just fortresses, not just palaces, but huge architectural statements of his power as a conqueror.
So for that reason, the story, the Edwardian conquest of Wales, lends itself very nicely to our Where History Happened feature, because we can trace it through these castles, as we've done. But one of the places you mentioned to highlight the story is Glastonbury, which obviously isn't in Wales.
No.
So why should Glastonbury?
Well, because, and this is something that I stuck my neck out on when I wrote my book on Edward, is that Edward goes to Glastonbury in 1278, 3 or 4 months after having defeated Llywelyn. So Llywelyn kneels before him at Christmas 1276. The next major festival in the Christian calendar, Easter, Edward goes to Glastonbury. And he goes there to dig up the bones of King Arthur. Now, the monks of Glastonbury had claimed since, I think, the 1180s, that they had the bones, the tomb of King Arthur. And this is where I sort of run the risk of antagonising Arthurian true believers, because that tomb was obviously a fake, because there was no such person as King Arthur. You know, this is where you get letters, but I'm perfectly prepared to believe that there was a man in, I don't know, the 2nd century AD in Britain, a Roman general or leader, called Arthur. Not a problem with that. Just as I'm prepared to accept there was a person, you know, in sort of 2,000 years ago in Galilee called Jesus, who gave the Romans some grief. But it doesn't follow from that that I have to believe in King Arthur and Camelot and round tables and all the other things that go with it, just as I don't have to believe in, you know, feeding 5,000 people with five fish or five loaves or whatever it is. So King Arthur, you know, the king of all Britain, that all that bit is made up. And that's why I sort of have no truck with the sort of, you know, well, there might have been an Arthur. Yes, there might have been an Arthur, but there was no King Arthur who ruled all of Britain. This bit is an invention of the later Middle Ages.
Geoffrey of Monmouth.
Geoffrey of Monmouth being in particular the culprit. And people, you get writing after Geoffrey of Monmouth saying, like William of Newburgh in the 1170s, saying all this stuff about King Arthur, I've checked in my venerable bead, all this stuff about King Arthur is made up, and this man was a liar. The problem is, for people like William of Newburgh, is that Geoffrey of Monmouth is a medieval bestseller. There are more copies of Geoffrey of Monmouth than almost anything else except for the Bible. Hundreds of copies exist. So it was hugely popular, and it's a whole industry. It's meant like Harry Potter if there was no copyright. You know, everybody loves it, and it just generates more and more and more stories. Now, I dare say that the English, some of them, they could say, well, this is clearly a sort of fantastical story. But they definitely believe that Arthur had existed, as Geoffrey of Monmouth had described. And so the monks of Glastonbury sort of think, well, we weren't in on this. They, I think, fake the tomb in the 1180s. But it's a good forgery. People are taken in, and by the 13th century, by the time Edward is born, it's just more proof that Arthur lived. You know, of course Arthur lived. He's got a tomb, and so you know this. And we can see Edward believes in Arthur, the reality, as everybody did, the reality of a historical Arthur. He writes to the Pope in 1301 when he's fighting the Scots and lists all the precedents for the kings of England having been rulers of Scotland, including ones that we know to be bona fide, like King Athelstan in the 10th century, ruling over Scotland. And in the distant past, King Arthur. You know, Arthur and Athelstan mentioned in the same breath. So they have no distinction between what we know to be legend and history. To them, it was a continuum. So Edward goes to Glastonbury to visit Arthur's tomb and to dig him up. Now, again, some people, I get emails about this from time to time, some people say, oh, well, that's clearly just fandom on Edward's part. You know, he is doing with Arthur what his father, Henry III, did with Edward the Confessor. It's just hero worship, and he's not sending any particular political message. To which I say, in that case, it's surprising that he's never been before. Edward's pushing 40, he's 38, I think, just 38 going on 39 at that point. There's no evidence he's ever been to Glastonbury before, if he's a big fan of Arthur. There's no evidence, I can say for a fact, he never goes again. So if he's a fan, this is a curious thing. It's curious that he goes to Glastonbury within months of defeating the Welsh and digs up Arthur. So what's he playing with digging up Arthur? Well, of course, the Arthur story is about King Arthur is a British king fighting against the Anglo-Saxons, the Saxon invaders, i.e. the English. The people who sort of claim Arthur as their own in the 13th century are the Welsh. Mm. You know, they are the descendants of the Britons. And when you get this in the propaganda that the Welsh are sending against Edward in 1282. They are the descendants of Arthur. They're the descendants of Brutus. They're descendants of Arthur. So this mythology, as we would see it, or history as they regarded it, was very much on people's minds. And I think, to conclude this, I think what Edward is doing at that point is digging up Arthur to say, well, I mean, he's honouring him, reburying the bones in great splendour, giving him a new tomb, but he's also saying this man is dead. Because, as I'm sure you'll know, Arthur was the once and future king. You know, he's not, the story went, he's not dead, he's just resting. He's just stunned. He's one day going to come back, so the Welsh believed. So he has this messianic quality, which I think Edward is putting to bed in the wake of his first war. I see it entirely as part and parcel, along with the castles and the legal reforms, and everything else Edward does in the wake of the First Welsh War. It's to put the issue of Wales and Arthur to bed.
Okay, so last question.
Yep.
By the death of Edward, mm-hmm. was the issue put to bed? Was Wales fundamentally and thoroughly conquered and under the English fold?
Yes. I mean, the Welsh have one more major rebellion in 1294, which Edward crushes, sends in even the biggest army he's ever sent in, 37,000 men, and builds one more great castle, which is Beaumaris on Anglesey. I know some people have written that rebellion up as a sort of tax revolt. I mean, there were clearly some people who wanted it to, saw it as a nationalist rising, which is going to drive out the English, because the leader of that rebellion, in the north at least, is a guy called Madoc Ap Llywelyn, distant cousin of Llywelyn's. And he styles himself Prince of Wales. So there's a kind of sense of, we're going to get this up and going again, this Welsh nationalism. But I think a lot of the support for that rebellion was about high taxes being imposed from England. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. The Welsh at that point never drive the English out again. There are rebellions in the south in 1316, and there's a more famous rebellion in 1400, the Glendower rebellion. But Wales remains a conquered country. So in that sense, Edward's conquest was permanent.
That was Mark Morris, whose book A Great and Terrible King, Edward I and the Forging of Britain, was published by Hutchinson. And you can read Mark's contribution to our Where History Happens series, talking about the conquest of Wales, in the August edition of the magazine. Finally, I caught up with historian and TV presenter Dan Snow, who's fronting, alongside Sean Williams, a brand new primetime BBC One history series called National Treasures Live. For 5 weeks, the show will be touring the country, coming live from some of Britain's finest heritage sites. So I asked Dan to preview the first episode.
The first film was at Dover Castle.
Right.
It's essentially Henry II's magnificent castle, one of the finest castles in the world. And I love it because it's had permanent military presence there from the Iron Age to the Cold War, so the 1980s. They had, obviously, Iron Age fortifications there. People forget, it's got one of the finest Roman ruins in the UK. It's got a three-story lighthouse. It's absolutely amazing. They've got a very fine Saxon church. They've got, they've got all sorts of medieval stuff, but largely Henry II's and then his son's extraordinary castle. And then, of course, they've got World War II. They've got Napoleonic stuff. They've got World War II tunnels. And they've even got, right down at the bottom, they've even got a regional seat of government from the Cold War in the event of a nuclear strike. Southeast England to be run from Dover Castle. Mm. So there's so much history. There's so much, something for everybody.
Okay. So a lovely place to film and to be, and a great place for people to visit. Obviously, there's, as you said, there's 2,000 years of history to explore there. What sort of things are you going to be looking at in that programme?
We've got the incomparable Lucy Worsley looking at chivalry. This whole question of did it exist, were knights really good, or was it just sort of, pillage and looting by another name? And that'll be good fun. We got Lenny Henry looking at racism in World War II for the service men and women who came back, who'd served in the British forces during the war from the Caribbean and then came back after the war and were sort of treated with sort of racist attitudes. And then we also have a strange segment in each programme where I'll be travelling around the UK with the celebrity hairdresser Michael Douglas from The One Show. And he doesn't know anything about history, left school at 15 without any history qualifications at all. And it's an attempt for me to enthuse him about history, teach him about some big, broad themes in British history, and show him some places that were so instrumental in forming the present.
And so where are you going for the first one?
In the first one, we'll be looking at the Normans. Since we're in a big Plantagenet castle, we thought we'd look at how the French first arrived here. We'll look at the Normans. And Michael Douglas asked me who Norman was, so I try and explain.
Okay. So obviously you want people to come to these shows, don't you? So do you want people to come to Dover Castle?
I'd really love people to come to Dover Castle. I think it's important to have lots of people there. I'm keen that history isn't presented as this sort of slightly niche, weird thing, but it's shown as the popular movement that it most definitely is. It's one of the most popular GCSEs, most popular A-levels, most popular subjects in university, for example. Yeah. I think it's important to get people out. And so if anyone wants to come down, they should get in touch with Dover Castle, check the website for updates, the English Heritage website for Dover Castle, and we'd love to see people.
National Treasures Live starts on Wednesday the 10th of August at 7:30 p.m. on BBC One. That's it for this week. Thanks to everyone who completed the Kindle poll that I talked about recently. The response was a fairly comprehensive yes to a Kindle edition, so we'll see what we can do about that. Of course, as ever, we're keen to know what you think about the podcast, so do email any observations to podcasthistoryextra.com or contact us via Twitter or Facebook. Just a reminder, the website for our new Tudor audiobook is historyextra.com/audiobooks/Tudors, a snip at £1.99. And next week we have Susan Duran on Elizabeth I, Richard Noakes on the Victorian Telegraph, and another preview from Dan Snow. I do hope you'll listen in.